Hi, I'm Frank Ferris, one of the principals of the Palliative Care Interdisciplinary Curriculum. I want to personally thank you for joining us for this module in our series on spiritual care.
Good morning. My name is Rabbi Wendy Unger. I am a chaplain with the palliative team at Riverside. I've been doing chaplaincy for about 15 years now and palliative medicine for about 10. Today's session is going to be Jewish patient needs and pain, terminal illness, end of life, and palliative care. There are three main movements in Judaism: Orthodoxy, Conservative, and Reform. The Orthodox movement is strict and traditional interpretation of the Torah. For those of you who don't know, the Torah is the Old Testament, five books of Moses, laws and commandments. In Orthodoxy, the Torah is unalterable. Now, that's a legal fiction, because, of course, we don't practice the way the people did 6,000 years ago. But the process of changing the laws is much, much slower in the Orthodox movement, and it's very difficult to change things. The current conservative movement is the acceptance of traditional and modern religious observances, conservation of Jewish tradition, but also changing to fit modern times. The Reform movement is a freedom to interpret the Torah and choose their religious observances. There are other movements that are smaller. Most are more liberal, though you will have heard of the ultra-Orthodox movement, and those are probably the people that you envision in your mind when you think about television with the hats and the side curls and the long coats. By the way, that dress, that's the Orthodox movement that says nothing should ever change. That dress originated in 13th century Poland. That was the Polish aristocracy's manner of dress, and the Jews adopted it after it went out of style, just to kind of elevate themselves, and they're still wearing it. No comment on that. Okay, Orthodoxy is the most fundamental of all the movements, adhering to written and oral laws. The delineation of the different movements comes down to how they see the transmission of what you would call the divine law. So Orthodoxy says that the Torah, five books of Moses, came straight from God, word for word, and therefore is unalterable. Though it does get altered. The conservative movement says that the Torah came down from God but was transmuted through man. Man had to write it down and speak it. Therefore, man is inherently fallible. So there is movement within the Torah, within the law, to interpret and to update as times progress. The Reform movement sees divine revelation as kind of completely made up. Kind of, it's a great idea, but man made it up kind of to improve themselves. Therefore, man is allowed to take on whatever of the laws feels good to them and enriches them. In Judaism, the sanctity of life overrides nearly all religious obligation. Therefore, the sick are exempt from normal fasting and other requirements. So, Yom Kippur is a 25-hour fast. Starts the night before, goes to sundown. There's always some idiot in synagogue who either has not taken their medication or has not eaten and has taken their medication and keels over in the middle of services. It's not a Yom Kippur without the ambulance showing up at the synagogue because someone has missed the memo. And there's always people I love the most who say, it's a 25-hour fast. I'm not allowed to fast. I have certain medical things that I'll just pass out, and that's not fun. So I have friends, I know people, friends, I don't know, who say, oh, fasting is the most important thing, but fasting's so hard on me. I can't go to synagogue. I have to go to bed. Someone's, again, missed the memo here. So people take on like little pieces of what they feel is so important, and they kind of miss the bigger picture. But the sanctity of life overrides all of these laws, except for a couple of the good ones, like killing people. So if you are sick, all the laws get pushed aside, and to save a life, pikuach nefesh is one of the highest levels that you can get. Just about everything is pushed aside, pikuach nefesh, to save a life. Commitments, obligations, duties, and commandments of religion have priorities over rights and individual pleasures. How I explain to people who are not Jewish what Judaism is, we just did this at the Ira Baya conference, was Judaism is not a religion of faith. It's religion of law. Faith is assumed. and the adherence to law becomes overwhelmingly important. Sanctity of life. Jews believe that people are created in God's image. That makes humans privileged to be God's partner in creation. Judaism believes that man and God are partners in creation. So when we talk about how, you know, people say, how could I possibly be sick? This is terrible. God's out to get me. Judaism does not function on that level. What Judaism would say in response to that was, hey, 100 years ago, you'd be dead. Like 10 years ago. So because we're partners in God's creation, that has allowed us to partner with the divine to make medical advances. So yeah, you're really sick right now, but you're not dead yet. You're welcome. So Judaism treats evil or sickness as a necessary part of our world, and us being partners in God's creation to make the world better and a better place for people. Judaism summons people to treat life and body respectfully. Our bodies are on loan from God and must be treated accordingly. So there's pages and pages and pages in the law book about whether you're allowed to pierce. Because is that considered a desecration of the body? There's pages and pages and pages about whether you're allowed to tattoo. And up until recent times, tattooing was against Jewish law. There's going to be a quiz. What changed that? What changed the law against tattooing in Judaism? Anyone? Amanda, you've taken this class before. But I'll call on you anyway.
The Holocaust.
Because it was at a point where you couldn't be buried in the Jewish cemetery if you had a tattoo, because it was a desecration on the body. And then all these people came out of World War II having numbers tattooed on their arms involuntarily. So the law was lifted. In each movement of Judaism, there is a law body of rabbis that sit and discuss with Shelot V'Tshuvot, questions and answers. So the questions are put before the law committees. The law committees decide. There's a majority opinion. There's also a minority opinion. So tattooing is now allowed by Jewish law, as long as you're not doing it for idol worship, because of what happened in the Holocaust. But the desecration of the body is a very big piece of Judaism, because it said that our bodies are on loan to us from God. Each Jew is commanded to respect the mitzvah, and a mitzvah is a commandment or a law, of pikuach nefesh, the preservation of life. This is a central Jewish commandment, taking precedence over almost all other religious regulations. So the example is given, you are not allowed to break Shabbat, do work on Shabbat. But to save a life, you can totally break Shabbat. And the example is given in the Talmud that a man sees a dog drowning in the pond. And the question is, can he break the Sabbath to save the dog's life? The answer the rabbi said, of course. That life, even though it's an animal's life, is so important that you are commanded to break Shabbat to save that life. Violating Jewish law to save a life is not only permitted, it is mandatory. Issues of filling out a DNR in accordance with halacha. Oh, this is fun. Jewish law strongly emphasized the preservation of Jewish life. In order to understand how this has played out in Jewish end-of-life care, it's important to look at the sources and the interpretations. Now, a DNR, do not resuscitate, is problematic in Jewish law. Why? You didn't know I was going to make you participate, did you? Why would a DNR be an issue in Jewish law?
I would think it's because if you already have this communication between you and God or part of creation, you might be influenced or interfering with what is natural.
Okay, that is a good point. Also, anyone else?
If the law is to prolong and preserve life, then the DNR kind of goes against that.
Correct. If the most important thing is to preserve Jewish life or preserve life, and you're saying do not resuscitate, that is problematic for some lawgivers. That you are actively going against the commandment to preserve life by saying it's okay to die and please don't touch me, I'd prefer to die peacefully. And the rabbis go back to the sources to explain this concept. In Ecclesiastes, King Solomon tells us there is a time to die. Scholars debated this and ruled that this means that when people reach their appointed time to die, death should not be prolonged. Here's where the argument comes in. What does it mean, time to die? And how do you define prolonged? So there are very specific legal terms in Judaism of when you're about to die. It's like a two-day period. And when you hit that two-day period, you can withdraw everything because that's imminent death. At that point, you're prolonging suffering. You're trying to prolong life. What's the problem with saying we have a very defined two-day period? We've got an individual with brain cancer. It's terminal. They want to withdraw all artificial nutrition and hydration, and they want to die peacefully and very well medicated. What is our issue if they are a religious Jew? Can we tell someone, oh, you're going to die in 29 hours? No. And you know, the minute somebody does that on the ICU, they're immediately wrong. The minute one of our staff says, oh, this is going to be quick, they're up on hospice and a week later chugging right along. You know, our bodies have wonderful ways of proving us wrong. There's no way to say to someone, you are going to die within this period of time. So when you're talking about a legal delineation of when someone's termed about to die, we can't do it. So it becomes very difficult. Let's try that again. There we go. So more stories from the sources. And these are all, the way Jewish law works is there is the issue that's being debated. And these are all in books and books and books of Aramaic. It's a lot of fun. And the rabbis come in and they argue. And the way these arguments are played out is they're brought in as proof texts from the sources. So that's what you're seeing here, all the proof texts that were brought in on this issue of when is it okay to prolong death? And when is it okay to say needless suffering is not appropriate, someone should be allowed to pass away? Story of Rabbi Judah, his students were constantly praying, which was keeping his soul from leaving his body. His housekeeper saw him suffering, and she climbed onto the roof and threw off a vessel, the smashing of which caused the students to pause. And the rabbi died. So there's great debate in the texts of whether this housekeeper was praiseworthy or whether she should be condemned for killing him. And the rabbis decided in the end of this debate, 5 pages later, that she was praiseworthy because she ended needless suffering. And here's where the issue of needless suffering comes in. The rabbis decreed that needless suffering is not part of Judaism. It's not a piece of the faith that we embrace or look for or think is good, and it should be minimized, which, by the way, becomes an issue in certain faith traditions, that suffering is a methodology of attaining the divine, which can be very problematic when dealing with end-of-life issues. Judaism also believes that we should not hinder the soul from parting. In Sefer Chasidim, the rabbis decreed if the person is dying and someone near the house is chopping wood so the soul cannot depart, then one should remove the wood chopper from there. And there's other very specific examples. I don't know why they did this, but apparently if somebody was dying, you could put the salt on their tongue and it would keep them from dying. I don't know. It seems, I don't know. It's in Aramaic. We just go with it. And then the rabbis decreed one is not to do that. One does not prolong suffering. Withdrawal of care. This is problematic. So Dr. Ferris asked me to bring this in. There's a question of at what point do you ask the rabbi? And the answer is be very careful before you tell someone that they should bring their faith leader in. There is a tenet in Judaism that says, if you're going to ask the rabbi, you best be prepared to follow the answer. If you're not going to follow the answer, if you don't like it, don't ask the rabbi. Just go out and do what you want. It's a very big tenet of saying sorry later is much better than actively disobeying. It's a different category of law of guilt. It's called l'chatchila medivad, l'chatchila ahead of time. If you do something knowing you're transgressing, it's a much greater, it's not a punishment, and there's no word for sin in Hebrew. It's a much greater transgression. But diavad, afterwards, and you did it, and you didn't know, and you say you're sorry, it's a much lower level of transgression. So this becomes problematic when people who don't know say, bring in your rabbi. Because what if your rabbi's a little bit more traditional and says, you can't do that? Then you have a problem. And we've had that problem of people calling their rabbis all over the world saying, can I do this? The rabbi saying, no, you cannot. and then they're stuck. So is it beneficial to bring in the family's rabbi? Maybe, depending on their point of view. Will they want to follow what the rabbi says? What are the legal and ethical issues? You have someone who's really caught in the crossfire. We had someone who was very Catholic, and she was considering withdrawing care. She had pulmonary fibrosis. She was declining. She knew it. The question was, would she continue treatment, maybe go for a trach to try to preserve life a little bit longer, or was it okay to just withdraw? Well, Catholicism has this issue as well. She asked us to bring in a priest. So we called in a priest that we knew really well. And who, you know, we said, can we call him Father so-and-so? This is where he's a priest. He's a little bit more liberal. She said, great, I just want a priest. I don't care who it is. I think she was just looking for permission to die. Brought in our priest who said, oh, yeah, go right ahead, honey. She felt much better. And she allowed herself to die peacefully. But depending, we also had a priest who, God bless him, was very, very conservative, kind of got kicked out of his own parish. He was so conservative. And this lady made him her healthcare power of attorney over her family. As she's writhing in the bed in pain, he's denying her pain medication because suffering is a way to attain the divine in certain faith traditions. It was very distressing for the staff and for her family, who had to stand by her bedside and watch her. And we finally brought in ethics and legal, who said we are not required to, you know, withdraw pain medication, etc. But you have to be very careful who you bring in, because you might not get the answer that you like, which can really complicate things for our family. A DNR. Most halakhic authorities only permit a do not resuscitate order for foregoing chest compressions and electronic defibrillation and cardiac arrest. So Judaism is very odd in this way. It says if you haven't started something, you don't have to necessarily start it. But once you've started something, if withdrawing that something is going to mean someone dies, you can't withdraw care. So when the DNR says, don't touch me, that's okay. But if you have someone who's a DNR CCAE and they're not a DNI, and you intubate them, and then 2 days later your ICU staff says, oh, this isn't going well, you need to withdraw care. Well, to pull the vent, we know is going to kill them. The observant patient's family is going to say, no, you can't do that. And then you've got a big problem. This can lead to difficult situations where people are put on ventilators and are unable by Jewish law to be removed. And this situation is to best encourage the family to consult with their rabbi. Unless you're not going to like the answer your rabbi gives, which case, consult with another rabbi. And people do that too. They're, you know, oh, my rabbi said, wait a minute, that's not your rabbi. He is today. The halacha imperative is that as long as we can keep people alive, we must do so, unless it's counterbalanced by extreme pain and suffering. And again, this is a matter of opinion. We don't have a legal definition of extreme pain and suffering. Dr. Ferris always talks about what's your line in the sand? It's one of his favorites. You're nodding. You've known that man. So we're sitting in a session, and he's teaching, and he says to us, the palliative group, okay, what's your line in the sand? And these are all medical people and pharmacists and social workers and a couple chaplains. And everyone's like, it's a 2. Yes, I'd be bedbound. And I'm like, 8. Yeah, at a certain point, no, I'm not doing this anymore. So for one person, we had a guy in hospice, and he came in for pain management, but he became incontinent. And he said, that's it. That's it. When I have to have a 20-something-year-old girl wiping my butt, I'm done. And he was dead within 2 days. So everyone has a their definition of what extreme pain and suffering is, and Judaism counts psychological and spiritual suffering as pain and suffering. It's on the same level. So in Israel, by the Orthodox rabbinate, if a woman gets pregnant, and this is a little odd, and she goes to the court and she says, I cannot go through with this pregnancy, it's going to kill me, she is granted an abortion. By law, she's given a prescription, and she can go get an abortion, which is a little different than what's going on in this country now, isn't it? We won't go into that. When consulting with a rabbinic authority on a DNR question, it's essential to clarify if there is a plausible cure or possibility for remission in the underlying illness of this patient. If the patient is in severe pain, his or her desires, and if the resuscitation procedures are likely to inflict severe discomfort in this patient. So if you have a patient, and we say in a lot of, you see this in a lot of treatments, if you survive the treatment, you could get better and have a life. So if they're talking about this treatment's going to be miserable, but on the other side of this treatment, you're going to be great and you're going to have an okay life, the rabbis could very well say, you need to go through the treatment because you're going to live through it. If someone doesn't like having dialysis, but dialysis is keeping them alive, there might be very much a debate of, well, you might not like it, but it's keeping you alive. So do we count this as extreme suffering? And there's different debates on this that goes. It depends. When we say to people, you know, doing CPR on your 86-year-old grandmother is not going to be good for her, we're not going to help. In that case, the rabbis would say, no, don't do it, because you're only going to hurt her and you're not going to improve her life situation. So it's a case-by-case situation. Not every movement allows a DNR. Three conditions in which a DNR can be permissible: expert medical opinion that the patient is terminal, that there's no possibility of a cure, and the patient is declining towards death. Almost every movement would say leave them alone and make them comfortable. Because if what you're doing is not going to prolong life and give quality of life, it's not considered a good life. The patient is experiencing tremendous suffering, either physically or emotionally, and again, emotionally and spiritually counts, even though they are receiving medication to control the pain, and the patient does not want to undergo resuscitation. Please note, it's permissible to withhold life-sustaining interventions in these cases, but it's always forbidden to withdraw them once they have become. This needs to be carefully considered at the time of making the decisions to intubate or not. When can care cease? Individuals suffering an irreversible and ultimately fatal condition can be categorized as dying for the purposes of halakha. Halakha means law, ruling on end of life. Based on that, extrapolations have been made about treatments that may be withheld from the dying. Mechanical ventilation, resuscitation, dialysis. If you haven't started dialysis, you don't need to. You can stop it. Chemotherapy and complex surgical procedures prolonging the dying process in the context of terminal illness. We had a case of a lady who had a disease that comes from smoking, and she eventually lost all of her limbs. And she was still shooting up drugs. She'd have people come up, her boyfriend come over and shoot her up and hold cigarettes up to her mouth so she could smoke. People do what they do. And she had terrible open wounds on her stumps. And they would debride them, and they were talking about doing more amputations. And basically, we had a torso here. And the surgeon sat down with her and her mother and said, we can do one more amputation, but if we do it, are we preserving your life? Are we giving you quality of life? And the surgeons decided that they were not going to offer the amputation. You know, we had a surgeon who said, I'm not going to operate. Really? And that surgeon sought the opinion of two of his colleagues who both agreed with him. The possible amputation was taken off the table because it was not going to preserve her life. Ultimately, she was going to die from this, and it was not going to give her any kind of quality of life. In the Jewish faith, one is granted autonomy, but within the constraints of Jewish law. And again, law trumps just about everything. And what is determined to be right and wrong in God's terms. Jewish law requires the preservation of life. We must do everything we can to prolong life. However, it's not obligated to initiate medical interventions that prolong suffering at the end of life. It is forbidden to do anything to hasten a patient's death, but one does not have to administer interventions that will briefly prolong a life of pain and suffering. And that's where we get artificial hydration and nutrition, or even oxygen. If you're going to put on a nasal cannula after you take off the BiPAP, but it's going to prolong this person's life but not give them any peace, you do not have to put on the nasal cannula. Some people prefer it, but Extubation. Oh, this is a problem. Rabbinic authorities generally agree that compassionate extubation is prohibited, as this would be an act of commission that hastens death. They do say that a person who remains intubated does not need to receive full life-sustaining cares, such as monitoring vital signs, blood draws, as well as adjustments to the parameters of the respirator. All right, Jewish law is fabulous at taking a teeny tiny loophole and driving a truck right through it. So the law says once you're on a vent, you cannot be taken off the vent. But it doesn't say you have to check everything else. It doesn't say you have to make sure the vent's being, you know, adjusted appropriately. It doesn't say you have to keep doing everything else. So people in this situation find ways around it. An implanted cardiac defibrillator can be deactivated, as this qualifies as stopping something that prolongs life rather than taking specific action that actively shortens life. This is gets into a lot of legal fiction, but what the rabbis are trying to do is preserve the law without causing additional suffering. So they're trying to maneuver with the law to go by the letter of the law without actually harming people. And that's where you see a lot of these little details. Stopping specific treatments such as chemodialysis is also allowed under the above thought process. Patients who are put on a ventilator will die on the ventilator, which is miserable for everybody involved. Artificial hydration nutrition. Okay, how many of you in the course of your careers have had issues with families when we get to the end of life who say, "You want me to starve grandma?" What, you know, I don't think this is a truly American thing. Growing up, my mother felt like if you were going to come to her house, by God, you would be fed. We went to visit somebody else's grandmother, my poor father, who does not eat fish. This woman brought out tuna fish. And I look over, and my father is eating it. I'm like, "Dad, what the hell?" And he's like, "Shh, if I say something, she'll make me a pot roast." I don't think it's just a Jewish kind of thing, but it is very cultural that we like to feed people. And we show people we love them by feed them. And this starts out as really early from when we have babies and children. You want to give your children the best food. We nurture people by feeding them. Then we get to the end of life, and all of a sudden we're saying to people, "We're going to stop feeding your loved one. We're going to take out the IV. They're not going to get liquids." And people are really horrified. "You're going to starve my loved one? She's going to die of thirst?" And it takes a lot of education by the team, palliative and hospice teams, to explain to people the physiological changes that happen at the end of life and how food and hydration can actually be harmful to people. But I think this is one of the most difficult concepts that people have in terms of end-of-life care, and it follows with this in Jewish law as well. As long as a person has viability, a little source life left. And again, this is a legal term, but there's no legal qualifications. What do we say vitality is? It's very hard to qualify that. Withdrawing nutrition is considered by most halachic authorities as actually hastening death. Facilitating access to nutrients to maintain vitality, even if done by medical procedure, is obligatory. Withholding nutrition from those who are unable to take it in orally is creating a cause of death, overriding the terminal illness. So clearly, Jewish law has a really hard time with withdrawing artificial hydration nutrition. It does go on to say, let me see if I put this on the next screen. An individual can only live approximately 2 weeks without food. In most cases of terminal illness, life expectancy exceeds this time frame, and therefore death is hastened by withholding nourishment. It also says if somebody is very adamant and says, "I don't want a feeding tube," you are not required to override them and put one in. So if somebody's wishes at end of life are very clear, the family can abide by them. In cases where death is imminent, is halakhically permissible, according to most scholars, to withhold nutrition. Again, what's imminent? About 48 hours. How do we know this? We never do. Among rabbinic authorities, artificial and nutrition and hydration must be provided to all patients, whether conscious or comatose, unless medically contraindicated. Jewish law sees nutrition and hydration as a basic necessity of life that must be provided even artificially. And again, this becomes very problematic for our patients and their caregivers, because you'll have your more religious patients and families actually horrified at you that you would even suggest to withdraw it. Have you ever seen someone who's not really responsive and families shoving food in their face? And, you know, the patient's actually choking on it or pocketing it. But it's a concept that really is very universal, that we feed people that we love, and if we're not feeding them, you're killing them. More artificial hydration. Jewish law authorities have ruled that nutrition and hydration may not even be passively discontinued for a dying patient to hasten their death. But if we say it's not going to withdraw artificial hydration, nutrition is not going to hasten death, and death is going to happen anyway, then it is more permissible to do so. On the other hand, should a patient refuse food or hydration, while they should be encouraged to accept it, they cannot be forced. If a patient refuses a feeding tube and is competent, their desire should be respected. Organ, eye, and tissue donation. Once again, the preservation of life takes precedence over everything in Jewish law. Therefore, donation of an organ that could save someone's life is permitted. Why might this be an issue? Again, desecration of the body, you are not allowed to desecrate the body. But to save a life, you can certainly do organ and tissue donation. Donation of tissue that can save someone's life or a specific faculty is permitted. What is the issue with eye donation? Based on this thought. Well, it can be considered. If you can save someone's faculty, and that goes to the senses, that's considered life-curing. Again, in the case of abortion, a woman went in and her pregnancy was causing her to be deaf. I don't know. I think they make this stuff up. And the rabbi said, in order to preserve her hearing, she was allowed to have an abortion. So to preserve a sense is the same as preserving a life. But what's the issues with eyes? What is the name of it? The eye?
Window to the soul?
No. What's the name of the organization that does the donation?
The
eye bank. So if it's not going to be used immediately, and it's going to be held aside for someone, then it's not saving someone's life, and therefore you cannot donate eyes. It gets a little tricky. Donation of an eye that can save sight is permission. Donation of a tissue that does not save a life or corneas that don't necessarily go to save vision is contested. Some rabbis saying the donation should be allowed because it improves the quality of life, and some saying donation is prohibited as it violates the body and does not save life. All right, so body donation. Where do you think rabbis would stand on that? Some would say no, but some would say yes. Why? Why do you think? Think like a rabbi.
So if you donate the body, then you're training medical professionals to save other people's lives.
Correct. Or if someone has a specific disease, we had someone with a really weird brain disease. It wasn't the Jacob, that one. It was a different one. But there's an institute that studies this brain disease. And the institute wanted just the head. So our pathologist accommodated it, and the rabbis would have said that is an okay, though gruesome, donation, because research into that disease will help people's life. So when I was a resident, they modeled the pastoral care residency on the medical residency, but it's not as hard as yours. So we were every other week, on the weekends, we were 12 on, 12 off for the whole weekend. Now, that's a violation of my Sabbath, because on Shabbat I don't drive and I don't work. So, again, you need to find that loophole and drive that Mack truck right through it. Orthodox rabbi, Rabbi Feinstein, in 1963 came up with an answer to medical students, Orthodox medical students who were doing their residencies and were in danger of losing their residencies because they couldn't work on Shabbat and holidays. And the ruling was by the Orthodox rabbinate, because they were training to save lives for the matter of their residencies and their work in the hospitals, they were allowed to break the Sabbath and go into the hospitals and work. Now we also see, and this is how Jewish law works, that spiritual and emotional life is considered to be on the same level as physical life. Therefore, Orthodox chaplains were also allowed to do those training. So I drove that Mack truck right through there and said, I'm good to go. Conversely, I had a conservative rabbi who wanted to do a residency, and she wanted to know how I managed it. So I went through this whole law process, and she went, oh, I don't think you can do that. Sure I can. And she ended up not doing a residency because she couldn't justify the work on Shabbat. It has nothing to do with anything. Autopsies. Because autopsies are a violation of the body, they are generally not permitted by Jewish law. In 1945 and 1949, the chief rabbinate in Israel gave the following exceptions. When an autopsy is required by civil law, it is permitted. There is a law in Judaism that reads, it translates to English as, the law of the land is the law of the land. You are not allowed to break the law of whatever your land you're in to the benefit of Jewish law. That's a basic self-preservation, I think, of a people. In the opinion of three doctors, the cause of death cannot otherwise be ascertained. Three doctors attest that the autopsy might help save the lives of others. Again, bikuach nefesh. And doing the autopsy might safeguard the surviving relatives from a hereditary disease. Case study. Oh, boy. So these case studies actually happen in the course of my career. One of them is a study from science, but this one is not. We had somebody's grandmother visiting from Brooklyn. They were out at Easton, and she dropped. Squad is called. What does the squad do? By law? They ran a code. And did she have a DNR? No, because you're not allowed to do that in Orthodoxy. No one ever thought about it. They ran a full code. She was vented and put onto the ICU. She had no paperwork on her, was coded and vented. At the hospital, it was decided that further care was futile, and staff began to speak to the family about compassionate extubation, which did not go well. The family, who is Orthodox, refused. Staff began to display distress and even hostility to the patient, as day after day the patient languished on a vent in the ICU. The local rabbi, the only rabbi working in that medical system, me, was called in to mediate the situation. So it was a lot of education. We explained to the staff what Jewish law was. Meanwhile, this family, again, don't ask the rabbi, is frantically calling grandma's rabbi in Brooklyn. Can we take her off the vent? And the rabbi says, no, you can't take her off the vent. You'll kill her. So again, they reached out to her rabbi, knowing what, you know, this was her guy, and the rabbi said no, and then they're bound to follow what that rabbi says, which further ties them into this situation. So in small groups, we met with staff and educated them about Jewish law and what the family was going through. I also sat down with the family, and who I knew, that's the stereotype that I just lived up to, and sat down and explained to them what the ICU staff was going through, their level of ignorance of Jewish law, and the fact that they were reacting to the state of the patient and just wanting to protect her. And the family kind of calmed down at that point. The family began to talk to staff and explain how they were calling rabbis in New York to get permission to remove the patient from the vent, were distressed themselves as they were denied permission. Family and staff began to bond as family and friends began to come in, bring kosher food for family, and invited the staff to join them. Now, in any hospital in Central Ohio, there is no such thing as kosher food. I once had like a 23-hour hospital stay, and I had to have liquids. I said, I need vegetarian. They brought me chicken broth. I keep kosher. I can't have the chicken broth. There was no such thing. And they looked at me strangely like, what? So for a Jewish patient who's in the hospital, either family brings in food, who's observant, by the way, or there's no food to be had. Some people, like myself, are comfortable eating vegetarian food in a non-kosher establishment. Some people are not. So this family, who is Orthodox, wouldn't touch the food at the hospital. So they weren't just bringing food. And they were bringing in hot plates, and there were little Sterno stoves, and it was ridiculous. But the family was really sitting vigil by the bed, and so there was someone there all the time, and they started to reach out to the staff and pull them in for meals. And the family and staff really started to bond. It was really kind of sweet. The patient died on the vent 2 weeks later. This is a case study from the Brain Tumor Foundation Award from 2014. In this scenario, it centers on Zoe, a woman with brain tumor metastases, and her family during the palliative phase of her illness. The following events occurred during Zoe's last admission to the hospital, during which she declined rapidly. In this case study, Zoe's Jewish. Zoe was of Polish descent and was an active participant in her Jewish faith. She was a homemaker with three children. She and husband Jack stated that religion played a significant part in their lives as they abided by the laws dictated by their Jewish faith. Zoe's mother, Marianne, was also very much involved in her care. Now, understand Zoe's mother is going to play a big part here. So if Zoe is an adult in 2014, that puts her mother alive at what time? Like a younger lady, at what time historically? During the Holocaust, which shaped whole generations. I went to the hospital in New Haven, Connecticut as an adolescent for something, it doesn't really matter, and my mother refused to tell the hospital that I was Jewish, Yale New Haven Hospital. You don't tell. And they thought I was going to have surgery. I didn't have surgery. The priest came in, full robes, with the bell, and started to bless me. And I started to freak out. I'm like, Mom, Mom. My mom said, shut up, it couldn't hurt. But even in that scenario, there is a real kind of feeling among Jews at the time that you don't disclose your Judaism because it could get you killed. Now, if Marianne is of Polish descent, this case study didn't say. It didn't say that how close in Polish descent she was. But her mother may have been, and I'm extrapolating here, of Polish faith during the Polish descent during the Holocaust, where you know Poland's Jews were slaughtered. Her mother, Marianne, was very involved in her care. Discord began when Zoe's condition began to deteriorate rapidly. As Zoe grew less able to communicate her wishes, Jack became her advocate and did not always act in accordance with the plans imparted by the healthcare team. This escalated conflict between the treating team and Jack. He insisted on feeding Zoe. We have an issue with this. When she was clearly at risk for aspiration, mobilized Zoe when she was at high risk of falls, and threatened to take her home without medical consent as her condition deteriorated and care needs increased. Marianne also insisted on feeding Zoe despite risk of aspiration, which upset the staff. The nursing team saw this behavior as denial, a common coping mechanism for family members facing terminal illness. Jack's true intentions were unclear, and the nurses were afraid Zoe would suffer from complications due to her husband putting her at risk. Frustrations on both sides increased. As the team began to suggest hospice and comfort care more and more, Jack began to pull away from the team and trust them less. Again, this is the basis of you don't hasten death, and the lack of communication really on the family sides about what their issues were really hurt the care team and the patient. Marianne and Jack began to have conflict over Zoe's condition as Marianne began to campaign for comfort care, and Jack saw this as a betrayal of Zoe in a hastening of death. As Zach began to resist more and more, an ethics consult was called to work on the situation, and Zoe died without any of this being resolved. Jewish faith uses terms as trefa, a palliative state where survival is projected is less than 1 year, and gosis, a state in which one is actively dying and is not more than 3 days in duration. Some rabbis say two. Again, these are the legal terms in Jewish law, and they're very difficult to be found, and you cannot hold a dying person to any of this. Prognosis for brain tumor patients can be uncertain, thus the point at which death may occur is difficult to predict. As a result, patients and families may be left in conflicting emotional opinions on how best to care for the patient, and often struggle to find a balance between relieving suffering and hastening death. Jack may have felt that Zoe had demonstrated vitality as he was not given a time frame, and maybe could not have been for Zoe's demise. Not only did Jack commit to feeding his wife, but also providing her with the best possible food, Jack took pride in carefully preparing nourishing meals for his wife and would often show and describe them to the nurses. Marianne also fed Zoe despite the high risk of aspiration. And it's possible that the family found solace in prolonging Zoe's life by preventing death by starvation. or not having that legal terminology of when she was in Gosa's 2 to 3 days death, felt that she did have vitality and therefore was obligated to feed her. The death of Zoe was made more traumatic and horrible as Jack lost trust in the staff and battled with both they and his mother-in-law. With better understanding of the issues of Jewish law, the conflict between family and staff might have been lessened and the experience less fraught for all. All right. That is the end of the presentation. I will tell you also, when you have a dying Jewish patient on the floor and someone, one of your patients dies, if they're observant, the family is going to want a room release. Why? Because the patient's body is not left alone from death until burial. So the Jewish funeral home in town actually has people they can call, and people get paid to do this, and they do this for a living, that when the person dies, they'll come to the hospital room, and they'll sit with the person. It's called shomer. It's a guarding. And they'll read Psalms, and to be with the person, because it is said by Jewish law that the time between death and burial, everything is centered on the patient. Once burial happens, everything happens for the family. And you know, Judaism has a 3-day burial law. I was talking to the head of the Islamic cemetery, really nice guy, and we were talking about, because Jews bury within 3 days, Islam buries as quickly as possible, and he was joking with me about it, that people don't really understand. He goes, from where we are, it's really hot. You don't want to hang around. So there's a part of that culturally also that's a very practical part, that preserving bodies is very difficult. In the Middle East, it is pretty hot, and you really don't want people hanging around for a long time. So you will also see your Jewish family slightly horrified at the idea of a showing or a long period of time between death and burial. So they're going to want the funeral home to come straight to the room and remove the patient, because the patient is allowed to be in the morgue by themselves, which can be a little bit traumatic to staff without some education as well. Now, does anyone have any questions?
So, like, within that 48 hours, and you I don't know what the proper term is, but you withdraw, you stop care, and again, patients surprise us all the time, and they live longer than that 48 hours, but at that time, as a medical sort of judgment, you think their patients are going to die in 48 hours, you stop everything and you're wrong. Is there a consequence for that?
No, you know, Judaism...
Should we start care, or how does that...
I think that would be really individual. The term is gosis. You're not required to actually remember that. And let's say we say this person is on huge amount of pressors, and once we take their pressors off, they're going to pass. So we extubate, they stop all medication, we make them super comfortable, and you're right, every once in a while they perk up and say, I feel great, I want a hamburger and a Coke. You know, they might take the tiniest little bite. But even with that, we often say, you know, that's such a small period window of time that the expectation is they're still in that period of gosis, even after 48 hours, still another 48 hours, they're still in that period. I don't think anyone would start anything up again. Anything else? Yes.
How, in your experience, how often do people blow off the rabbi who tells them not to do something that's interesting?
Personally, constantly.
Okay,
yeah, I actually tell people, don't ask your rabbi. Really, don't ask unless you're really going to follow it no matter what they say. Because in terms of transgressing law, it's a much greater transgression to be told what the law is and actively transgress the law than kind of not know what the law is. And so kashrut. Keeping kosher, we don't mix milk and meat. So this is the example given in the Talmud. If you're making a meat meal and by mistake a drop of milk goes into your brisket, you're fine. Don't worry about it. It was a mistake. You didn't mean to. You're not going to throw the whole thing out. This is crazy. But if you intentionally think, I'm going to drop some milk into the brisket, it's going to make it taste great, and you do it intentionally, then by law you're required to throw it out. So that's the delineation of the different laws. To ask and don't ask. All right? Anything else? Well, I thank you for your patience this morning. This was always a lot of fun for me. And have a great day.
Thanks again for tuning in. I hope you'll rate and review this podcast and share it with your colleagues and your friends. So you don't miss any of our new content, make sure you are subscribing to PCIC podcasts. PCIC is sponsored by PalMed, where our aim is to advance palliative care globally and ensure all clinicians have the latest knowledge and skill. To access more PCIC content, please visit palmed.us to review our extensive open access PCIC curriculum.